Let's hear God speak to us from Genesis 26. Now there was a famine in the land beside the previous famine in Abraham's time. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and will give them all these lands. And through your offspring all nations on the earth will be blessed because Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him, keeping my commands, my decrees, and my instructions." So Isaac stayed in Gerar. When the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," because he was afraid to say, "She is my wife." He thought, "The men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, because she is beautiful." When Isaac had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife, Rebekah. So Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, "She is really your wife. Why did you say, 'She is my sister'?" Isaac answered him, "Because I thought I might lose my life on account of her." Then Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of their men might have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech gave orders to all the people, "Anyone who harms this man or his wife will surely be put to death." Isaac planted crops in that land, and the same year reaped a hundredfold, because the Lord blessed him. The man became rich, and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy. He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped up, filling them with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, "Move away from us. You have become too powerful for us." So Isaac moved away from there and camped in the valley of Gerar, where he settled. Isaac reopened the wells that had been dug in the time of his father Abraham, that the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham died, and he gave them the same names his father had given them. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with those of Isaac and said, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek, because they disputed with him. Then they dug another well, but they quarreled over that one also. So he named that Sitnah. He moved on from there and dug another well, and no one quarreled over that. So he named it Rehoboth, saying, "Now the Lord has given us room, and we will flourish in the land." From there, he went up to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord. There he pitched his tent, and there his servants dug a well. Meanwhile, Abimelech had come to him from Gerar with Ahazath, his personal advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his forces. Isaac asked them, "Why have you come to me, since you were hostile to me and sent me away?" They answered, "We saw clearly that the Lord was with you, so we said, 'There ought to be a sworn agreement between us, between us and you, let us make a treaty with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we did not harm you, but always treated you well and sent you away peacefully. And now you are blessed by the Lord." Isaac then made a feast for them, and they ate and drank. Early the next morning, the men swore on oath to each other. Then Isaac sent them on their way, and they went away peacefully. That day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well they had dug. They said, "We've found water." He called it Shibhar, and to this day, the name of the town has been Beersheba.
Jenny, thank you very much for reading for us. I want you to think about those verses for a little while, and as I say, that will lead us to the Lord's Supper. This is one of the few stories we're actually going to get about the life of Isaac. Much more about Jacob and Esau and their conflict, that story that got started this morning at the end there of chapter 25. But here in chapter 26, we get a little snapshot of the life of Isaac. One of the things that we're going to notice is just how much he is following in the footsteps of his father Abraham. I briefly thought I might have been original in giving the title for this sermon, "Like Father, Like Son." That is, until I went onto the internet and discovered everyone calls their sermon "Like Father, Like Son" when they're preaching on Genesis 26. There are lots of good reasons for doing that. One is just the number of times that Abraham is actually mentioned in this chapter. He's there in verse 1, reminding us of that famine that was experienced in Abraham's time. Then in verse 3, the oath I swore to your father Abraham. In verse 5, because Abraham obeyed me. Verse 15, his father Abraham, the wells that have been dug in the time of his father Abraham. Again, in verse 18, after the time of his father Abraham, and after Abraham died. And then in verse 23, when God reveals himself to Isaac, he says, "I am the God of your father Abraham." It really stands out in the flow of Genesis. We're actually only going to hear Abraham's name a few more times. There'll be 15 times in the next 23 chapters that Abraham is named. Just 15 in the next 23 chapters. But 8 times in this chapter, we're constantly being reminded, Abraham, Abraham, this is Abraham's son, Isaac. But then his son's life follows in the footsteps of Abraham in lots of ways. I don't know how far you got into reading Genesis 12 a few minutes ago during our brief interval. You probably got to the first 3 verses where we see God promising blessing to Abraham. And we'll see that repeated again. There's a story of famine and travel. Verse 1 reminds us of it, that there was another famine besides the famine in Abraham's time. Abraham experiences famine, goes down to Egypt. When he's there, he lies about his wife and calls her his sister. There's a deception around his wife. And there are tensions and separation. That's actually on the left-hand column. That should be Genesis 13. It's when Abraham and Lot, there's quarreling between their shepherds, and they separate out, a little like we see in this chapter. God promises descendants in chapter 13, and we see that echoed here. Isaac builds an altar, and there are blessings with and relations to foreigners. It follows the pattern of chapters 13 and 14 really closely. The life of Isaac is following the pattern of the life of Abraham. And actually, if we'd had a longer technical breakdown, we could have looked at Genesis 20 and 21, where you would see Abraham doing all of the things that Isaac does here. It's another replay. In Genesis 20 and 21, we're back in the land of Gerar, just where Isaac is. And this chap Abimelech and his advisor Phicol appear again. Abraham deceives them about the identity of Sarah. It's the second time that Abraham lies about his wife being his sister. Then later on, because God simply works it, there is blessing and agreement and treaties between them. So in Genesis 26, we are seeing, as we move from that generation of Abraham into the generation of Isaac, Isaac's life retraces the steps of Abraham very accurately. We see over and over again him doing the same things, experiencing the same things, finding that God blesses him. So why does Genesis do that? We've just got going in that story of that great conflict between Jacob and Esau. Why now pause and see this life of Isaac and this repeated pattern of all the same things happening again? Well, there's a couple of things that I think we should take from it. Firstly, that God promises to bless his people. God promises to bless his people. We'll see that first, and then we'll see that nothing can stop that. So God promises to bless his people. Verse 1. There was a famine in the land besides the previous famine in Abraham's time, and Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and will confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and will give them all these lands. And through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed, because Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him, keeping my commands, my decrees, and my instructions." Just about word for word, what God promises to Abraham there in Genesis 12 is repeated here. God promises to bless his people. He promised that blessing to Abraham. It's being restated now, not secondhand, but freshly to that second generation. Also, those verses pick up not just what God promised back in Genesis 12, but also his oath in Genesis 22. After God asks Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, and Abraham is faithful in being willing to do that, God says, "I've promised you in the past, but now I'm going to make an oath. I'm going to swear on myself that I will surely do these things." And at these verses here, reminding us of that, that God has promised blessing, and in response to Abraham's obedience, he has gone on oath to make doubly sure that he is going to bless people. So God is determined to bless, and we're hearing those same promises repeated again to this next generation. God promises to bless his people, and nothing can stop that. It's what the rest of this chapter really shows us. First of all, not our sin. Here is Isaac. He is where God has told him to be. God has, there's a little variation from the life of Abraham. Remember, Abraham, in response to his famine, did go down into Egypt. God says, "You don't need to do that. You can stay where you are, and I will be with you, and I will bless you." Great promises, great reassurance. But what does Isaac do? Isaac thinks to himself, like his father before him, "I'm not sure that I can trust God and leave this with him. I need a plan." So he decides to deceive the Philistines there in Gerar. Verse 7, when the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," because he was afraid to say, "She is my wife." He thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, because she's beautiful. When Isaac had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife Rebekah. So Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, "She's really your wife. Why did you say she's my sister?" Isaac answered him, "Because I thought I might lose my life on account of her." God has just promised astonishing blessings to him, guaranteed those, reminded Isaac of the oath that he has sworn, and he's afraid and thinks, "I could lose it all unless I come up with a plan." And so we get a kind of repeat of the incident that happened twice in the life of Abraham. There's some small differences again. The first time, when Abraham was in Egypt and said, "Sarah's my wife," there were plagues that brought that lie to the surface. Then, when he does it later on in chapter 21 and deceives Abimelech about whether Sarah is his sister or his wife, God appears to Abimelech in a dream and helps him realize that this has been a deception. This time, Abimelech simply looks out of his window and sees Isaac laughing with his wife or being intimate in some way, and so realizes what is going on. There are some small differences, but the thing we should really notice is the repetition. It has just happened again. Abraham and Isaac, this family trait, this repeated pattern of those who are not trusting in the Lord. And yet, what is God's response? Well, it comes to light, and verse 12, that determination to bless just carries on regardless. Verse 12, Isaac planted crops in that land and the same year reaped a hundredfold because the Lord blessed him. Just a wonderful little reminder that here are God's people failing again to trust him, and God, just as promised, is determined to bless. And the next thing that we read about is God wonderfully blessing the people. Just that little picture that God experiences no fatigue, no sense of, oh my goodness, they've done it again. And that is now true from one generation to the next. So when Abraham makes that same mistake and deceives a second person about his wife Sarah, God still is promising to bless. And so too, now as he sees it from one generation to the next, they're going to be no better. And this theme of deception, it's only really going to get worse. Abraham deceived, saying, she's my sister. Isaac is doing it, and we've just had the birth of Jacob, whose name is, he deceives. A family of deceivers, but God is determined to bless. And nothing's going to exhaust his patience on that. It's wonderful. There's that pattern a little in superhero movies. You might have noticed it where at various points the superhero just becomes a little fatigued because frankly they just keep having to rescue people over and over again. And why can't the place just stay saved, and why can't evil stop rearing its head or something? The Incredibles has one great example of that. As Mr. Incredible is just reflecting on the frustrations of being a superhero. No matter how many times you save the world, it always manages to get back in jeopardy again. Sometimes I just want it to stay saved, you know, for a little bit. I feel like the maid. I just cleaned up this mess. Can we keep it clean for like 10 minutes? You can imagine God looking around and thinking, seriously, again? Do I have to keep stepping in? Does my mercy have to be new again and again and again? Wonderfully it is. Well, this week I've been thinking about, you know, that time when Peter comes to Jesus and says, Lord, how many times should we forgive somebody? Seven? And I think we're right to assume Peter there is trying to be generous, but also has just got a limit in view on how many times we might keep forgiving somebody. As you'll know, Jesus' response is a wonderful one. Seven times seven. In other words, just 70 times seven. Just countless times. Always seeking to find that capacity to forgive. As I was reflecting on it this week, I just wondered, was there ever a moment where Jesus might simply have said, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. What do you mean? That there would ever be a point where my instinct wouldn't be to forgive? I imagine in Jesus' mind that just doesn't actually compute, that I would think to myself, there is a point where my attitude is not going to be an openness to forgive. Because that is what we see in God. Generation after generation and sin after sin, we see God being willing to forgive, never prepared to draw a line, always determined to bless. A great reminder as we come to the Lord's table to see how our sin worked out repeatedly in our own lives, as one generation just repeats the patterns of another, that does not prevent God's determination to bless his people. And then just secondly, not our sin, not the world's opposition. God will bless his people, despite all the tensions that then start to emerge through the rest of this chapter. So have a look down at verse 14. Isaac is greatly blessed. This harvest of a hundredfold, things are going really well. He becomes rich and his wealth continues to abound. Verse 14. He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped up, filling them with earth. It's a pretty, what sort of an action is that? It's kind of petty. It's kind of self-defeating. These are wells that everyone could be using, but they're going to fill them up with earth. It's also, I think, trying to remove any sense that God's people have a foothold on the land, and that to have dug a well and to have named it is part of making a stake in the land, of taking a stake in the land, of having a place there. And so it's partly erasing that. Well, it goes on in verse 16. Abimelech says to Isaac, "Move away from us, you have become too powerful for us." It's a little like what the Egyptians say as Israel multiplies in Egypt. They've become too numerous, we need to get rid of them. And so Abimelech requests that move, and Isaac agrees, verse 17. Isaac moved away from there and camped in the valley of Gerar. So moving away from, forced to leave, those crops and that blessing and that wealth and that stability, and they go out into the valley of Gerar. He settles there. They reopen some wells that were dug in the time of his father Abraham, which the Philistines had filled up after Abraham died. So more things going just as they did for Abraham. They managed to find some fresh wells, verse 19. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a fresh well of water there, but the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with them and drove them further on. And they said, "The water is ours." So he names the well Esek, meaning dispute. And then they dig another well, and there's quarreling about that. And so he moves on further away, verse 22. Pushed further and further out and away into the wilderness. It just feels like life is getting harder. They're being driven away. God has blessed them, and that's just provoked the jealousy of the world, and they are driven further away. And yet, what happens? God, not for the last time, provides water in the wilderness. They are driven out, and they just discover well after well. And finally, in verse 22, they move on from there and dig another well, and no one quarreled over it. He named it Rehoboth, saying, "Now the Lord has given us room, and we will flourish in the land." Wonderful provision in the wilderness for God's people. They've been driven out. This quarreling and opposition has arisen, but the Lord provides for them. And then it just gets better and better. Verse 23, "From there he went up to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared to him and said, 'I'm the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I'm with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham.' Isaac builds an altar there, pitches his tent. They dig a well." And then Abimelech appears on the scene. What are you expecting at this point? I would think some more opposition. They've been driven away, and they've been driven out into the wilderness. And here comes Abimelech with Ahuzah, his personal advisor, Phicol, the commander of his forces. It doesn't sound like good news. But see what happens, verse 27. Isaac asked them, "Why have you come to me since you were hostile to me and sent me away?" They answered, "We saw clearly that the Lord was with you. So we said, 'There ought to be a sworn agreement between us, between us and you. Let us make a treaty with you that you may do us no harm, just as we did you no harm.'" "But always treated you well and sent you away peacefully." "And now you are blessed by the Lord." Isaac made a feast for them and they ate and drank, and there is peace and there's a treaty between them. Abimelech comes along and slightly glosses over the way that he's treated the people badly, but he just comes out to sue for peace and to acknowledge God's blessing. It comes from nowhere. It just comes from the Lord, I think, that they have been driven out into the wilderness. They've had to experience God's provision there and faithfulness. God has just kept on blessing them. And now the cherry on the top. Here is peace and feasting and a deal with a treaty with Abimelech, one that establishes peace. And then the news comes back to Isaac, that the servants who dug a well come back and say, "We found more water." He calls it Shibar, and to this day, the name of the town has been Beersheba. The Lord's just constant provision. God's people are sinning through this chapter and being unfaithful in some very boring, repetitive ways. They're experiencing the hostility of the world, and yet here, sheerly because God wants to bless his people, we go from news of a famine at the start of the chapter to peace and feasting and water by the end of the chapter.